This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There is still a great deal we don't know or don't know for sure about the attacks in Mumbai last week, who planned it and where, the identity and even the number of the attackers. We do know that after almost 3 days, 172 people are dead, 239 more wounded. We know how the attacks were executed and we know the targets: the central railway station, a cafe, a hospital, a Jewish center, two luxury hotels, and the city of Mumbai, India's financial center, home to the movie studios collectively known as Bollywood, the most diverse and, many say, the most vibrant city in the country. If you're from Mumbai, if you visited, what do the targets tell you about the message, the goal of the attackers? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, we'll talk about the problem of balancing human rights and the fight against terrorism with the new UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. But first, what the targets tell us about the attacks in Mumbai. In a few minutes, we'll talk with writer Aravind Agdida, who set his Booker Prize-winning novel The White Tiger in his hometown. But we begin with Brian Jenkins, a security analyst for the RAND Corporation, who joins us from a studio there in Santa Monica, California. And Brian Jenkins, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
A train station, a cafe, a hospital, two luxury hotels, a Jewish center. What do you glean from those targets?
Well, we tend to describe terrorism as senseless violence, mindless violence, but it seldom is. That doesn't mean the terrorists think as you or I think. They have their own world view. But if we look at the attacks from their perspective, we can discern a terrifying strategic logic here. Terrorists seek three goals: attacking targets that are icons or that have emotional value, to use their terminology, obtaining high body counts and causing economic damage. Now, we know that they were determined to create high body counts by the nature of their tactics, and also the captured terrorist, is reported to have said that their instructions were to kill the maximum number of people. Insofar as the venues, these are accessible venues that the train station. We have seen terrorist attacks before in train stations, on trains. Public transportation offers easy access. It offers large concentrations of people in confined environments that enhance the use of explosives. The selection of the Jewish center adds their particular notions about killing Jews, and of course that's why India was selected. India is, in their view, a Hindu nation, and Hindus, along with Christians and Jews, are the enemies of Islam. Ending the attacks and making their final stand in the two landmark hotels provides them with the dramatic venue. I mean, Mumbai itself, as you already pointed out, is the commercial and entertainment center. It's India's Wall Street. It's India's Hollywood. It's India's Zurich. It's India's Milan. It's prosperous. It symbolizes modern India. And by choosing these two hotels, the Taj Mahal and the Oberoi, these are icons. They are filled with foreigners, and we know that the terrorists wanted to kill foreigners, particularly Americans and Britons. But they're also gathering places for the local elite, and the message to the local elite is nowhere is safe.
Nowhere is safe. Obviously a terrifying thought. A hospital?
Again, we have seen attacks on hospitals before. Terrorists don't operate according to the Geneva Conventions, and therefore attacking a hospital is a way of deliberately heightening the terror. I mean, we expect conflict to follow certain rules. Therefore, the deliberate, dramatic violation of those rules heightens the fear and alarm. In a sense, they're saying we will stop at nothing. Again, nowhere, not even a hospital is safe.
Let's get a caller on the line again. If you've been to Mumbai, if you're from Mumbai, give us a call. What did the target list tell you about the message the terrorists hope to send? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Mike is on the line. Mike calling us from Las Vegas in Nevada.
Hey, how are you? Yeah, well, listen, real quickly, I was in Mumbai in 2001 and found it to be just the most pleasant place I've been in a long, long, long time, even though even back then there were signs of security around, you know, around the city. Slightly heightened security that you'd see in European cities or especially United States, but there was a sense of security. But even with that, I felt very comfortable. You know, it was just a very, very, very interesting place to be. I felt very comfortable and safe. So when I look at the targets and, you know, how these guys carried out what they did, I'm sure, as the your guest says, it was to disrupt that feeling of comfort and safety no matter what. And I believe that you know, they do these things like that because the root cause of that is that they feel that there has been some overwhelming injustice done. And until we address those injustices from the perception of those who feel that their franchise has been violated, we will continue to see these kinds of attacks all over the world. And I think it goes much deeper than just people who want to disrupt the serenity of the free world.
And Mike, would you visit Mumbai again if the occasion called for it?
I mean, I think that I was just in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and I mean, if you go to the south side of Chicago, 59th and Sangamon, in that neighborhood, you can be attacked at any given point in time. So I would definitely go back to Mumbai and even some of the other cities that have been targeted. I would not allow this to keep me from traveling as I do worldwide, but I'm just saying just the talk of it could happen in any city at any time again is enough to disrupt economies and to get people thinking and acting out of fear. And once more, and I'll let this go, that the governments around the world have to go back and revisit how disenfranchised thinking or disenfranchised people in reality have been treated all over the world. And when they have nowhere else to go, when they don't feel that there's a sense of justice or anybody caring about their plight, and that goes across a number of groups, you're going to see these kinds of things continue and probably escalate until we really seriously look at the root causes of these things. And it's not just a random acts of terrorist violence because they don't like all of the freedoms that we enjoy. That's a bunch of hokey. And I think that I would encourage people to continue to travel. And in spite of this, perhaps the terrorists may see that it does not impact people's ability to make judgments about where they travel. I don't think anywhere is safe.
Mike, thanks for the call. Joining us now for an insider's view of Mumbai is Aravind Adiga, the winner of this year's Booker Prize for his novel, The White Tiger, and he joins us from his hometown in Mumbai. And it's nice to have you with us today on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you for having me on. Nice to be on.
And the fact that these attacks occurred in Mumbai, well, what does that tell you?
Well, the first thing to tell you is that the target list was far more extensive than the Western media seems to believe it was. This is one of the frustrations for us living in Mumbai. There's been a lot of focus in the West, in the United States and in England, on the two hotels that were targeted, the Oberoi and the Taj Mahal Hotel, both of which are very important places here. But the terrorists also targeted our central train station, the Victoria Terminus. They also went into a hospital and just strayed bullets around. They sent a car packed with explosives to the airport, and they went into a poor neighborhood and shot a lot of people. Their prime target was just the people of India and the Republic of India. And tourists and foreigners were targeted insofar as tourism is one of the mainstays of our economy here, especially in the city of Mumbai. The main thing to note with this pattern of attack was that the terrorists were trying to weaken India, to destabilize India. A secondary focus appears to have been a hatred of Israel because they targeted a place where Jewish visitors are known to congregate when they come to Mumbai. The main thing they were out to was to target important symbolic locations and also places with practical consequences like train stations and hospitals.
And the symbolic importance, Brian Jenkins, our other guest, was talking about that earlier. Would that be the Taj Tower and Hotel?
Yes, quite so. Because this is a place that it's a very important hotel here, but it's also close to one of our main landmarks, which is the Gateway of India, which is a big arch near the ocean where the last British soldiers left India. So it's a national monument. The Taj Hotel is both a hotel and a civic monument in the city because it's part of the Great Plaza around the Great Gateway of India where the people from all over Bombay go just to walk around and just to feel they are in Bombay. This hotel has immense symbolic significance, and to target it is kind of to simultaneously hit the elite of the city, but also to target the entire city.
As I understand it, one cannot have seen too many Bollywood movies without seeing the Taj Hotel.
Yes, very much so. It's kind of a synecdoche. It's the symbol of the city. If you're shooting a film, a Bollywood film or a Hindi film, and you want to very quickly suggest that your hero and his main girl have taken the train and gone to Bombay, you show them getting off and going to the Taj Hotel and having a soda outside. So while it's a very expensive hotel, frequented by the business elite and the elite and visitors from across the world, it's also a place that's of immense symbolic significance to all people in the city of all economic classes, because we see it and we know where we are in Bombay. We are at the, we are in the city of Bombay. So it's quite important to us here. It's almost like a town hall in a sense, like the Hotel de Ville in Paris. That's what it's like.
Stay with us, if you would, Aravind Adiga. We're going to also ask Brian Jenkins of the RAND Corporation to stay with us as well. And we'd like you to join in, too, if you've been to Mumbai. If you're from Mumbai, call and tell us what these target lists suggest to you about the message that was being sent last week and what its meaning is. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There are still more questions than answers about who committed last week's atrocities in Mumbai, in India, and why. We do know the number of those killed and those injured, and we know the targets they attacked. The city of Mumbai, as we've heard, two luxury hotels, the railway station in town, the main terminal. They attacked a cafe, a Jewish center, and a hospital as well. What meaning do we derive from that? Our guests today are Brian Jenkins, a security analyst with the RAND Corporation, and Aravind Adiga. He's the author of the Booker Prize-winning novel The White Tiger and a former reporter for Time magazine in India. And Aravind, let me ask you, how is the city responding in the aftermath of these attacks? We keep hearing reports that things have returned to normal, that it's a resilient kind of a place, but there has to be a hangover.
Yeah, it's interesting because this is not the first terror attack we've had here in the city. My very first reporting assignment for Time in 2003 was to cover a bomb in the city in Bombay, which is just outside the Taj. So the hotel has always been targeted as a potential location. In the previous attacks we've had in Bombay, and some of them have been very severe, the city has bounced back the very next day. Business has been back to normal the very next day. As I speak today, it's been almost a week. It has been a week, actually, since the beginning of this terror outrage. And the city has still not quite got back to normal. I mean, this is quite extraordinary for this city where people are very tough. You have to understand that normal life in Bombay is no cakewalk. It's very difficult here. 60% of the people live in slums or on the pavement. So we're talking of a city where people are used to struggling for survival, and a bomb blast doesn't affect them much. So what has happened, this terror attack has been so extraordinary that it has shaken the people here. I was just going around the city talking to various restaurant owners and cafe owners, and they tell me business is still down about 25% from where it should be at this stage. So there's no question that this time it has taken a bit longer for the city to come back. But that said, people here are tough, and they will be back to normal in a couple of days. I do believe that.
Aravind Adiga, we thank you for your time. We know it's very late there. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Aravinda Diga, the winner of this year's Booker Prize for his novel, The White Tiger, which is set in his hometown, Mumbai, and he joined us on the phone from there. Brian Jenkins, as you heard the combination of the former reporter, now a novelist, describing his city, clearly the idea of spreading terror attacking the financial capital of India was part of this attack.
It certainly was, and this will cause economic damage to India, which certainly was among the objectives. While your earlier caller, Mike, said that he would be ready to go back to Mumbai, inevitably an attack like this will result in cancellations by tourists to travel to India. We know that the travel and tourism industry is exquisitely sensitive to concerns about security. There's another thing that was mentioned, and that is not only the killings at the hospital, the attack at the hospital at a restaurant, but also just a killing ordinary people in a poor neighborhood, and that relates to another of the terrorist goals, and that is a terrorist attack like this carried out by Muslim extremists. By doing so, they hope to exacerbate antagonisms between India's Hindu and Muslim communities, and perhaps even provoke Hindu reprisals. And we have seen in the past reprisals by outraged populations, which can easily get out of hand, like the 2002 massacre of more than 1,000 Muslims in Gujarat. And that increase in tensions and reprisals in turn facilitates recruiting by the Muslims extremists. So certainly, from their strategic point of view, they will judge this as a success.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Khalid. Khalid with us from Miami in Florida.
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for taking the call. I do believe that the attacks on Mumbai does represent the new era of attacks, because they usually target cities like with big financial centers, and just like what happened with New York.
And London and Madrid.
And Madrid, yeah. The problem is that there seems to be a disconnect between what really, the media here really, thinks of those attacks and why they are happening, and then what's the justification. Of course, there's no justification for killing innocents in any case, but there seems to be a disconnect between that and then what really we read on the internet from, for instance, the Kashmir Muslims being attacked and killed on a daily basis by the Indian government. And that kind of disconnect will lead us to nowhere, because you will never solve a problem if you really don't know the causes and the issues that, you know, in those regions. The same thing in, you know, what's happening in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We need some kind of a real solutions for those problems. Because you will never be able to stop such attacks, because it's so easy to recruit anyone nowadays. When you see your brothers or your sisters or your cousin being killed, by the other side.
And Brian Jenkins, Khalid refers to Kashmir, the group that's, I guess, the prime suspect here is a Pakistani-based group that coalesced around the issue of Kashmir, the divisions there, and unresolved since the partition of India back in 1947, and the cause of conflict ever since then.
There's no question about that. The Muslim Kashmir ruled, and certainly often with a heavy hand by Hindu India, provides a further cause for the terrorists. And the terrorists also see India increasingly becoming an ally of the United States, thereby elevating its status as a target in the eyes of those jihadists that are inspired by Al-Qaeda's ideology. Some of these groups even look forward to the creation of an Islamic state in India itself. Now, with Muslims comprising just 14% of India's population, that seems to be an unrealistic goal. But nonetheless, they do derive some benefits. They increase tensions between India and Pakistan, while I suspect that most people in Pakistan are as horrified by the terrorist attacks as everyone else in the world, the prospect of another armed confrontation with India or India conducting military attacks on suspected terrorist training bases will provoke anger and strengthen the hands of those in Pakistan who support a hard line against India. It also may have the immediate benefit of persuading Pakistan to redeploy some of its forces from the frontier tribal areas where it has been going after militant jihadists to defensive positions against India. And, of course, any slackening of the Pakistani forces in the frontier areas further complicates things for NATO and American forces in Afghanistan. So there's a variety of grievances that are being addressed here with a variety of strategic goals.
Khalid, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Kazad. Kazad with us from Columbus, Ohio.
That's Kazad, yes. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great. Now, thank you for the show. I actually grew up and was raised within a sort of a one-mile radius of most of the targets that were hit and have spent a lot of my life at the Taj, at the Oberoi, and Cafe Leopold. So it was at one level sort of quite personal. My mother actually had been at the Taj for three nights in a row right before the night before the attack. And since the attacks had been sort of ongoing and being planned for, over a week, they said they had a command center set up in the hotel for at least 7 to 10 days. That made it sort of all the more capricious in that the attack could have happened a day earlier, a day later, and who knows what different groups of people might have been affected. The other thing that I want to say is that the train station that was attacked, which was now known as the Chhatrapati Shivaji Station, used to priorly be known as the Queen Victoria Terminus. It's sort of our Grand Central and Penn Station all combined in one. And one of the reasons I think it hasn't been receiving as much press, at least in the Western media, is because the people that were targeted and attacked there were largely poor or maybe lower middle class. And I think that something needs to be said about that as well.
Now, those are the pictures that we have seen in the papers, the one place the gunmen were caught on video cameras in discernible images. So we have seen those pictures in the newspapers. And
correct, but not much has been made. I mean, the focus has really been on the two elite hotels.
And Brian Jenkins, we did hear a lot about the gunmen looking for passports of Americans, Britons, even Chinese and Israelis, of course, as well. Nevertheless, the vast majority of those killed were Indians.
There's no question about that, and in fact, that can sometimes backfire on some of these terrorist attacks because killing ordinary people really causes revulsion worldwide on these things. And we do have to keep in mind that the majority of the casualties in this particular case were ordinary people. They were not selected on the basis of their passport or their residence. They just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that raises some questions about the motives of the attackers themselves. We've talked about the strategic goals of the planners, but for the attackers themselves, it's a different story. And one of your callers alluded to it when he said that in today's world, it is easy to recruit people like this. What we're looking at here are individuals whose homicidal, suicidal fanaticism run deeper than their declared beliefs. I think it reflects a peculiar personality type, if not outright psychopathology. In today's globalized grievances, one can adopt a reason for aggression. These guys are self-radicalized, disposable killing instruments. You know, you only need to insert a SIM card to program them into action.
May I make another point?
Go ahead, please, Kazak.
Two of the other issues that I think need focusing, and perhaps this will happen as we gain a little distance from these events. One is the role of ultra-Hindu nationalism and fundamentalism and its rise in the last decade. That has directly contributed to the further radicalization and aggression of these groups. And I think the other, I hope that this becomes a discussion, at least in India, if not around the world. One of the strange things we have in India is that we have a sort of a very weird multi-leveled legal system in that we have a sort of a basic national civil law or civic code, but then we also have Muslim courts and Hindu courts and Zoroastrian courts, and places where people can sort of choose whether they want to, you know, seek legal justice within the national system or within their own particular sort of communal or religious system. And I think that the first thing that India needs to do in light of these recent events is sort of have one standard legal system that applies to every single citizen and doesn't allow people to take refuge when it suits them within their own communal legal system.
Kazad, thank you very much for the
phone
call.
Thank you
very much. Appreciate it. We're
talking
about what the target lists in Mumbai. Tell us about the message being sent by the attackers. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's an email from Gita in Baltimore. I was born in Mumbai in 1962. My father lived in Mumbai all his life. Mumbai is the most diverse live-and-let-live cultures I've ever known. People are accepting of all the different people who live and visit the city. It breaks my heart that security and trust are now lost in yet another great place on our earth. As a naturalized American citizen, my heart breaks for the people of Mumbai. Education and diplomatic relations between the countries of the world and the Muslim world is the only solution to this problem. And yet, Brian Jenkins, obviously, as you've pointed out, there seems to be, and perhaps it's understandable, a nationalist reaction both in India and in Pakistan, which feels somewhat threatened by the government there, just elected, certainly doesn't feel as if it's responsible as a matter of governmental policy for these kinds of attacks. The attackers may have come from Pakistan, but nevertheless, this is not something wished by the government in Islamabad.
Well, this is something that will be further investigated. Further, the role of Pakistan and there's a spectrum of possible involvement. At one level is simply that these individuals found refuge in the in areas of Pakistan where the Pakistan government does not exercise its own authority. These rugged tribal areas, and so Pakistan certainly didn't, in that case, wouldn't approve of the operation, but simply happens to be the unhappy host to these organizations. Up from that is the fact that some of these organizations, in fact, were created or supported by Pakistan in order to wage a guerrilla warfare in Kashmir, as a consequence of the continuing conflict there over the future of Kashmir. And therefore, while the Pakistani government may not have approved any specific terrorist operation, the Indians may still want to hold Pakistan responsible for the creation and support over the years over some of these groups. A level above that would be the possibility that rogue elements within Pakistan's intelligence services, who have been identified as behind some terrorist attacks directed against India,
and some
notably
directed
the bombing
against, and some directed in Pakistan too, Afghanistan too.
True. Notably, the bombing of the India's embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, and up from that would be, which is highly unlikely, would be that Pakistan's government approved this operation. Now, that's certainly not likely to be the case, but as one of your callers indicated, there are nationalist, extreme nationalist elements within India, Hindu nationalists, who are going to make some political capital out of these attacks in order to further their own positions within India, and confrontation with Pakistan fits that political agenda.
And we do forget that I think in 2002 it was, there was an attack on the Indian Parliament. Again, many casualties, not quite on this scale, but many casualties. And, both sides, marshaled their armies on the borders. These are two nuclear powers, and we came rather close to a war.
That's true, and this is the great concern, and that's why what happens in Mumbai is not only a shocking event for the world to watch, but creates alarm throughout the governments of the world who are worried about the possibility of a military confrontation that could turn into a nuclear war between the two countries, and therefore there's a tremendous diplomatic effort right now to ensure a degree of cooperation between the Pakistan authorities and the Indian authorities to thoroughly investigate this event and to assure the Indians that there was not Pakistan involvement in the operation.
Brian Jenkins, a security analyst at the RAND Corporation. Stay with us, if you will. We're going to take a couple of more questions about what the target lists in Mumbai tell us about the nature of the attacks, the goals of the attackers, and, well, what in fact has been achieved. We also hope to talk with the new UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. So stay with us. I'm Neil Cownan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. Our guest is Brian Jenkins, security analyst at the RAND Corporation. We're trying to divine what meaning we can from the target list of the attackers who committed atrocities last week in Mumbai, the financial and media center, entertainment center of India. More than almost 200 people killed, more than 300 injured in those attacks. And the sites included, of course, two luxury hotels, but also a railroad terminal, a cafe, a hospital, a Jewish center. What do we find out from those attacks and from the city in which they were sited? And, well, let's see if we can take some more of your phone calls. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Omesh is on the line. Omesh calling us from Fremont in California.
Hi. I grew up in Bombay and lived there for a substantial part of my life before I moved to the U.S., and I was in the Taj just a month ago having dinner with a bunch of friends who also were actually eventually caught up in the same incident and were locked up in a room for 7-8 hours.
I hope they got out all right.
They're fine, thank you. I'd like to make a couple of points here. One is the security paradigm in Bombay and in India in general is, you know, the idea of security is a very different concept than what we have in the U.S., especially post 9/11, where we've kind of had a loss of innocence, as it were, and a very different idea of what security means. And I think some shift of that nature will probably have to happen even in Bombay, though I can't imagine how it's going to be executed. And that's what the owner, the CEO of the Taj Hotels, Ratan Tata, actually brought, I think, attention to that point when he said that the security infrastructure in India was woefully inadequate when the commandos that eventually helped rescue the situation had, you know, it took them 7 hours before they reached Bombay, which is kind of unacceptable by almost any standard for a country with the resources that India has. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, the second point I'd like to make is there's a different understanding in India, in Bombay in particular, of the involvement of Pakistan and whether there is truly at the heart of the administration in Pakistan, whether there's truly an interest in resolving this, getting to the bottom of this. Where we've had repeated attacks in the past, and we've had fingers pointed. We've had, in fact, there's a list of 20 individuals that the Indian government has repeatedly given Pakistan who are being sheltered in Pakistan, who are directly involved with a lot of these acts of terrorism. And there's been no movement on that list since 1993, I believe, when Dawood Ibrahim, who was the primary accused at that time, who apparently lives in Karachi, you know, in full public sort of, it's very evident that he lives there. There's individuals like that the government has never ever gone after. So there's always been suspicion in a lot of people in India that at the bottom of this, there is no interest in preventing these acts from the Pakistani side. So there is an issue of trust, a severe issue of trust and confidence there, which it will take a remarkable, you know, set of actions on maybe on both parties to overcome that distrust.
Thanks very much for that, Omesh. I appreciate the phone call. And Brian Jenkins, as he points out, well, a couple of interesting points, one of which there have been other attacks in Mumbai before, of course, Mumbai, previously known as Bombay. They have largely been bomb attacks set off by either timers or cell phone detonators. This was something, in terms of its execution, rather different.
I think it was, and I think in this particular case, you know, there has been some criticism, even within the jihadist circles, about some of these bombing attacks as being unmanly. Now, that sounds odd to us, but we're talking about a warrior subculture here. And I suspect that those who actually carried out the attack certainly were convinced that going down shooting was better than secretly planting bombs in public places, even a more attractive ending than blowing themselves up in suicide bombings, even though suicide bombings might have caused even more casualties. This, in a sense, for them, was an opportunity to demonstrate their conviction, their courage, although it doesn't require a lot of courage to gun down unarmed people. But it becomes a kind of a real-life video game killing fantasy for the actual attackers themselves. Now, the previous caller mentioned increasing security, and of course, the difficulty in increasing security is that these are public places, and despite the increases in security that we've seen here in the United States, it is still extremely difficult to protect public places. I mean, people have to go in and out of train stations. People have to be able to go in and out of hotels. We can't turn hotels, hospitals, and train stations and restaurants into fortresses. So all of these public places are going to remain vulnerable to those who are determined to kill and willing to kill indiscriminately.
He also mentioned the list of 20 people the Indian government has repeatedly asked Pakistan to extradite. Of course, the Pakistani government says, well, if you would provide some evidence, please, we can't just send them back to India without any evidence.
In some cases, it's a matter of evidence. In some cases, the Pakistanis say that we don't have information about these people here. We could not apprehend these people ourselves. Now, whether that is credible or not is another issue. And again, you have to put this into the historical context that India and Pakistan have been at each other's throats since the creation of India and Pakistan themselves. They fought three wars. There have been an additional number of military confrontation and close calls, and the majority of the Pakistanis regard India as the principal threat to the survival of their nation. So again, while I suspect many ordinary Pakistanis will be horrified, as we all are, by these attacks, nonetheless, for some, there's a certain schadenfreude that this is happening to a state that many regard as an enemy, and cooperation has not been adequate. It's been one of the diplomatic goals of the United States and others who are friends with both Pakistan and India to try to bring about some type of rapprochement between the two countries that would enable them to combine their efforts against these extremists. But this type of attack, as we've seen from the calls, only arouses the suspicions between the two countries.
Brian Jenkins, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Jenkins, a security analyst at the RAND Corporation, with us today from a studio there at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California. Stay with us. We'll be talking about the tension between human rights and the fight against terrorism, but right after this.